Broadcast out of New York City, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on the Progressive Radio Network. On Monday, January 28th, 2013, I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo. Thank you for joining us on our weekly Prescriptions for Health show on the Progressive Radio Network. Every Monday, live from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and from 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. Remember, our shows are available 24-7 on PRN.FM and drsaputo.com.
Today, you will hear Vicki's 2020 health tips at 20 after and 20 to the hour. And we've got another great show for you today that will include what you need to know about medical marijuana.
And can hyperbaric oxygen boost brain repair?
Does what a cow eats affect your risk for heart disease?
Moo.
Oh, my gosh.
Are immunized babies healthier?
And what about NSAIDs? Are they safe for kids?
So it's time to talk about marijuana. You know, cannabis is a highly debatable and controversial political hot button, and none of us wanted our kids to smoke it. And when I was growing up, it wasn't around, and then I don't know if I want to age myself so much.
I don't know about that. When I was in high school, we had a green fence. It was on the other side of the football field, and all the tough guys used to go back behind the green fence, and they'd smoke cigarettes, and once in a while, they'd have a little pot.
Oh, really? Well, if they did it, I just didn't know about it.
Well, you were goody two-shoes, I think.
I guess so. But in the 60s and 70s, we did hear more about it. And I noticed smelling it at parties a little, where people would tell me that they smelled it. I wasn't sure what I was smelling. But I was always told it was addictive and that it led to stronger narcotic use like heroin and cocaine. And so when I was growing up, I was really afraid of it.
I'm not so sure it's addictive that way. As it is something that leads to something that's deeper and bigger and gives you more of an effect. I think that's more what it's like. I'd say 95% of people that smoke pot now and then could take it or leave it, depending on what they feel like.
Why do you think that it's illegal instead of, I mean, there's so many drugs that are prescription or over-the-counter. Do you think that it's illegal because it's smoked?
Well, no, I don't think that's the
reason. I mean, they could just put it in pills.
It's a business, you know. Like they say, follow the dollars. And the marijuana business is huge. I mean, the underworld is making billions and billions of dollars every year on the sale of
drugs. There are a lot of people that are just making it in their closets and in their backyards.
That just shows you how big a marketplace there is. And yes, most of the time they're getting away with it, but it's against the law. And so there are problems, and most people aren't going to grow marijuana because it's too big of a deal. If they get caught, they don't want to pay the consequences.
Well, why do you think it's against the law? Is it really that bad?
It's not about being bad. It's just about the marketplace being what it is. Like I said, follow the dollars. If you've got a mafia that's controlling the sale of these drugs and they're making a lot of money, you can bet they're going to be lobbying in Congress to make it stay illegal to use because otherwise they don't have a business.
So maybe that is a good reason to make it so that it wasn't illegal.
Sure. I mean, that's what they've done in other countries. And look at Prohibition back in the 30s, okay, or the 20s and 30s. What happened there? They had a big deal with alcohol, and now all of a sudden, because it's legal, it's okay. And before it was legal, it wasn't okay. I mean, what should the government be telling us? How should they be regulating us? What does that interfere with in terms of our personal rights?
Well, I mean, you can kind of see why it wouldn't be a good thing to do when you were going to drive, just like with alcohol.
Well, like any drug-altering substance. How about Valium? You want to take that off the market?
Yeah.
Or Klonopin?
Vicodin or anything that people...
All those drugs. It's the same thing. So how do you differentiate one from the other?
But why don't doctors rely on it more often for pain and to increase appetite when people need that? I mean, those are a couple of medical uses.
Yeah, they're just afraid. It may be legal in California for medical marijuana to be used, but at the federal level, it's not legal. So if the Federal Trade Commission wanted to come in and bust you, they could.
Even though it's legal in your state.
That's right.
Huh. Well, tell us about this Tel Aviv study.
Well, it's just a small study, but it's interesting because it shows what's happening at a level that's at the real level where people live. And they had just 19 residents, okay, that were in a nursing home in Israel. And the results of giving them medical marijuana for a year was amazing in terms of it increased their appetite. They gained weight because a lot of them were thin. They had a reduction in their pain and in their tremors. There was improvement in their mood and their communication skills.
Yeah, I think we ought to go get all these old folks in the nursing homes high. They'd probably be happier, feel better.
It's not just about high. See, high is what we associate it with. And you know, God bless them.
Like
give them
said,
a little
though,
highness.
They wouldn't have as much pain and they'd have a better appetite. So
let's separate the highness from the medical uses, even though I'd say being high could be a medical use too. I mean, it's not like it's a dangerous drug. It doesn't have a lot of side effects. You couldn't take enough marijuana to kill you. You'd have to imbibe like pounds and pounds of it. It's that safe.
Hmm.
And so what we're talking about here is just what the law happens to be.
So let's talk about some of the benefits of taking it besides the pain and the anorexia. What would be other things? I guess it'd be good for chemotherapy patients because if they have nausea and vomiting, isn't it good for that?
Real good for that. It's good for the pain of cancer. I mean, that's a real good use for it. It works as a good antioxidant, and it works to help people gain weight. If you take people who have HIV and they have wasting disease, it works very well, and it's one of the FDA, I guess I don't know if the FDA has approved it, but it's certainly approved by our state to be able to use because we know it works.
And don't also people with HIV sometimes get peripheral neuropathy?
Absolutely, and it's one of the ways you could treat that and one of the ways you can treat chemotherapy-induced peripheral neuropathy, but you know I have kind of a bias about that because we're doing a
clinical... With a photon stimulator? Well, people could come in and get a photon stimulator treatment and smoke a little pot or eat some Alice B. Toklas brownies.
Well, that's right. I mean, what we're talking about here is common sense. What do we want to try and accomplish using a drug like marijuana? And it has lots of wonderful effects that we should be supporting. And there's nothing... I mean, look at this. 5 European countries sanction it. Canada does. 17 U.S. states do, and 14 others are considering it. So grass is legal there.
Well, I thought it was interesting to read that it can decrease cancer tumor growth.
Well, maybe. I mean, these are studies that have been done that are preliminary. And I know that there's a wonderful book that's called Integrative Oncology that Donald Abrams, who's chief of oncology at San Francisco General Hospital, has written a chapter in on marijuana. I highly recommend it because it's one of the best resources I've seen that looks at the different aspects of what marijuana can do from a medical point of view.
What's the name of the book?
Integrative Oncology.
Mm-hmm.
Andrew Weil was the co-author of the book along with Donald Abrams. So we've got a book here that really shows some of the value of it. And it also shows how complicated it is. You know, we talk about something called THC, which has got a long name, and that's why nobody wants to say it. It's Delta-9-tetrahydrocannabinol.
So, sounds like
I can't even say it myself.
Cannibal.
Right, and that's the psychoactive part of the drug, of the plant. But there are about 70 different kinds of drugs that are in that, and maybe 400 compounds that altogether affect things like cerebral blood flow, which it increases. It increases cortical activity of the brain. It kills respiratory pathogens, so it's great as an antibiotic to some extent.
Wow.
It's a great antioxidant, as I was mentioning earlier.
Anti-inflammatory?
Yeah. So we're looking at a miraculous plant that has been used for thousands of years, a couple of thousands of years.
Isn't it also good for people that have nightmares and post-traumatic stress disorder type flashbacks?
Yes, it works pretty well for people who have that kind of problem. And why not use it? You know, again, we run into the problem of what doctor wants to take the risk of prescribing that if they know that even though it's legal in California, that they could still be busted by the feds? Or what if they're in a state that where it isn't legal? Are they going to – I mean, we know intellectually as scientists that it's a good thing to do. We even know that we can reduce the number of medications that people are taking because it works in so many areas.
So why is it illegal?
Same old thing. Follow the dollars. It's about that
companies.
Simple.
Well, because it's natural, I think. Is that –
Well, you can't patent
you
it.
You can't patent it.
No, that's
there you
right.
go. That's it right there.
All right. So you have to look at the story, but who benefits?
And it would reduce the use of a lot of chronic medications that are used for pain and, like you were mentioning earlier, tremors. So like maybe Parkinson's and mood elevators and sleeping pills because marijuana can do all those things.
Well, it's one of the most underused botanicals that we have that really should be brought forward in a much bigger way. But until we work out the political, economic issues that are involved with its manufacture and distribution and sales, it's not going to happen because it's follow the dollars.
Well, what would be some of the downsides to it?
Well, I mean, we don't want everybody potted out, right? And
because it makes you kind of high.
Well, you might not be able to drive safely. You can't operate machinery right. You may not be able to
think
clearly.
It affects your coordination.
Think of what alcohol does.
Reaction time and all that. Yeah, it'd be like a DUI.
It would be a DUI if you're driving under the influence of something.
Can it affect your vital signs too, like your pulse? It would make your heart rate faster?
It makes it a little faster. It can agitate you. It can stimulate you to have more in the way of panic attacks. So that's something to be concerned about. Some people are concerned that it might make people who have a tendency towards schizophrenia or manic depressive psychosis or profound depressions to get much worse, and I'd agree with that. I don't think I'd be playing around with drugs like that in people who have that potential. So that would be a downside. But every time we start talking about whether or not marijuana should be legal, we should also be comparing it to alcohol, which I think is a far more dangerous drug. And it's far more addictive. I mean, look at the kinds of problems we see with people who come into the hospitals when they stop their alcohol and they go into the DTs, you know, delirium tremens, or a Korsakoff psychosis where they're imagining things or they're completely psychotic from it. And sometimes it lasts for a long time and it causes cirrhosis. I mean, all those things are really problems. You don't see that with marijuana.
You wouldn't be needing, instead of AA meetings, you wouldn't be having MA meetings.
No. I mean, you could have them because anybody who abuses anything needs some help to try and change what they're doing. Because we need to look at the reasons that are involved for why we drink too much, we eat too much, we crave sex too much, we do all the things that can be done to excess. There's always a reason. And the job of the physician is to look at those reasons rather than just say, stop drinking or stop using alcohol or stop using drugs, because it's serving a purpose for people. People would not do these things if they didn't have some kind of benefit from it that they perceived, even though it may be short term and in the long term may be lethal.
Well, I think I'd like to go back for a minute to how it decreases cancer growth, because I was learning that it causes apoptosis and it inhibits angiogenesis and it can help to slow down metastasis.
These are preliminary studies that are done, what I would say are in vitro. See, there are two different kinds of studies that are done. One is in a living animal or person, and the other is done in a test tube. So if you put cells that are cancerous in a test tube and then you put a little of something in it, like a certain fraction of marijuana, you'll see these kinds of changes occur, but you don't know what's going to happen in the clinical setting in the whole person. We know that marijuana doesn't cause lung cancer. That's a biggie, because if you smoke it.
Because chemotherapy can have a side effect of causing cancer.
Well, chemotherapy can, but that wouldn't be the reason that I would be looking at here. I'd be primarily...
Because of the smoking.
Yeah, because cigarettes cause cancer, and they cause lung disease and lots of other problems, the heart attacks and strokes and diabetes, et cetera, et cetera. But when you smoke marijuana, it may affect your lungs, and a lot of people have a marijuana cough, and they can go on and have chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and for them, they shouldn't be smoking it. If they're going to use it, they should be doing it in some other way. So, I mean, that makes sense. But the primary thing I'm trying to say is it doesn't cause lung cancer, and studies have been done on that. In fact, what you just reported gives us hope that maybe that would be something that could fight cancer.
Yeah, maybe if you had lung cancer, if you smoked marijuana, maybe it would go right to it and help it.
Well, see, that's a nice thought, and it could be right. But
it's so hot, maybe it'd just burn it out.
Well, hyperthermia is one of the things that we use. That's a good point, Vicki. Hyperthermia, you know, cancers hate things that are hot. You get over 106 degrees, and cancer cells will die sooner than your normal cells. And that's why we're sending people to Europe and sometimes local places when they're doing clinical trials, looking at the effects of high temperature on cancer cells, so that's not so silly. But the main thing about marijuana is that it has all these wonderful effects that we like in medicine, because it makes people who are ill feel better. And that's part of what being a physician is about. So we need to support these people any way that we can. And using medical marijuana makes perfect sense to me.
Well, then you were talking about addiction, and it seems that there's more of a psychological craving rather than a physical withdrawal that people would have, which is why it's not commonly thought of as addictive.
Well, if you're only emotionally addicted to it, if you stop it abruptly, there shouldn't be any cravings like there are with other kinds of addictive drugs.
But a lot of people that are alcoholics drink because they're craving it before they start getting physical withdrawal. It's just they really want it.
But that addiction is very physical and very biochemical. And the effects of alcohol withdrawal in somebody who's addicted to alcohol can be lethal.
Mm-hmm. I mean, so maybe you could say that it was habit-forming rather than addictive?
Well, people use it for a reason.
Well, what do you say about chocolate? I mean, like, I crave chocolate.
Yeah, well, you're not addicted to it from the point of view of your biochemistry.
Yeah, I mean, but maybe psychologically.
Well, you want chocolate, you're going to hunt it down, right? But if you're an alcoholic and you don't have alcohol, you're going to go into withdrawal. That's no fun. That's like going into heroin withdrawal.
So what about marijuana, then? You're not going to go into withdrawal.
That's very rare. That's very, very rare. So you don't have to worry about that so much. So the physiological things affects addiction is much more important than the psychological one, but they both are.
But I want to just make it clear that we're not trying to encourage people to smoke or use marijuana. We're talking more about it for medicinal reasons.
Well, I mean, let's get real, okay, and talk about those people that use marijuana recreationally, because that's how people are using it for the most part. Is there something wrong with that? No, I don't see anything wrong with that at all, because I am not in a position to judge anybody. What I will say is it has effects that I worry about, because I have to look at why are they doing it in the first place. And people turn to drugs when they can't solve the problems themselves. They can't solve the stresses or the depression or the anxiety or the PTSD or whatever symptoms they're having. And that can be a major issue, and they need some kind of relief. I think they make a smarter choice when they use things like marijuana as opposed to alcohol or heroin. But it's not like it's the only thing. I mean, that's not the big issue. So for me, medical marijuana is a good idea. I don't think we should have laws that make smoking marijuana or using it in any other form illegal. These are the rights of people to decide, but in this country it's not that way because of the way the laws are. And until we change that, people are going to just have to be careful about not getting caught, even though our laws are changing, particularly in states like California that are pretty progressive. So medical marijuana, good idea. Smoking it in a place where you may get caught and have the fines and all the rest of it, got to be careful. Use your common sense. Okay, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. It's time for Nurse Vicki's first 2020 tip on the Charles Schultz philosophy. And when we come back, we'll be talking about, can hyperbaric oxygen boost brain repair? Stay tuned.
I'd like to share the philosophy of Charles Schultz, the creator of the Peanuts comic strip. You don't have to actually answer the questions, just ponder them. First one is, name the 5 wealthiest people in the world. Name the last 5 Heisman Trophy winners.
Jeez.
Name the last 5 winners of the Miss America pageant. Name 10 people who've won the Nobel or Pulitzer Prize. Name the last half dozen Academy Award winners for Best Actor and Actress. And name the last decade's worth of World Series winners. So how did you do?
I didn't get any of them right.
Okay. Well, the point is that none of us remember the headlines of yesterday. There are no second-rate achievers. They're all best in their fields, but the applause dies and awards tarnish and achievements are forgotten and accolades and certificates are buried with their owners. So here's another quiz. See how you do on this one. List a few teachers who aided your journey through school.
All right. I can do that one.
Name three friends who have helped you through a difficult time.
Easy.
Name five people who have taught you something worthwhile.
More than five.
Think of a few people who've made you feel appreciated and special.
Indeed.
Think of five people you enjoy spending time with.
Geez, I'm getting good at this.
Those are easier, aren't they?
Yes.
Yeah, well, the lesson is that most people who make a difference in your life are not the ones with the most credentials and the most money or the most awards. They simply are the ones who care the most.
That's right.
And I want to add something else. Remember to be yourself because everyone else is taken.
That's true. Boy, that guy's smart.
You know, nobody wants a brain injury or a stroke. And brain damage can be pretty debilitating. We've all heard that if somebody has a cardiac arrest, that it's important to give CPR immediately so that there isn't brain damage from lack of oxygen to the brain. So we're going to talk about the encouraging study in Tel Aviv that shows how a hyperbaric oxygen chamber can actually repair damaged brain tissue.
You know, before we get to that, I just want to say that there have been people doing that in this country for 20 years. So it sounds like it's brand new.
I think it's more than 20 years because I remember in the 60s
yeah.
going and touring one of them.
Mm-hmm. Well, most of it's done in major hospitals, but a lot of it's done by complementary and alternative people who just go to the cutting edge. They're the pioneers of tomorrow's medicine. And some of the work they're doing is amazing. Well, in this particular study we're talking about, they looked at 74 people who had had a stroke 6 months to 3 years prior. And one group got hyperbaric oxygen therapy for the first 2 months of the study. The other group got nothing, and then 2 months after, they got the hyperbaric oxygen therapy. They had 42-hour sessions, and it came to five times a week. So they got a fair amount of oxygen therapy, and each time it was in about 10 atmospheres, which means they got 10 times the amount of oxygen that you and I would get if we're just breathing here at room air. And the results were shocking. I mean, people who had had strokes for a long time were recovering in lots of different ways. They're getting their speech back. They're getting some movement back. They're getting sensation back.
Isn't that a miracle? It just seems like a miracle.
Well, when you think about it, it actually isn't. But when you appreciate what's happened and the fact that all of a sudden, all these years later, they improved. It's like a miracle because
we
didn't expect it.
Why don't they do this on everybody that's had a stroke routinely?
Well, it would be something that should be done routinely. I mean, there are a lot of things that change. You know, we started doing a lot more for people who had strokes in the general medical field a lot of years ago when we got these clot busters that we would be able to inject in somebody who had a thrombosis in their brain.
Right away when they were in the emergency room,
yeah,
right?
You do that within 4 hours or so of the time that the stroke occurs, and the chances are you're going to keep a lot of those symptoms from ever developing because you're going to stop the process.
But usually
usually
when you've heard that somebody's had a stroke and they're paralyzed and they can't speak,
yep,
and they have numbness and so forth, and they've had it for a long time,
yeah,
nobody would
permanent.
Dream that it could be reversed.
Well, here's the mystery uncovered.
It's like why
okay?
It's not being done.
Well, that's why it wasn't being done is because nobody was thinking about what was actually happening. When you have a clot, a blood clot in your in a blood vessel in your brain, the tissue that's normally served and nourished by that blood vessel is no longer nourished. And so it dies without nutrition. It can't make energy. It can't repair itself. It goes into acidosis and it dies. There are many cells that are around that area that are called the peri-infarction area, the area around the infarction where the blood clot is, that don't have good blood supply. They can't function normally, but they're not dead either.
Oh.
And that can be a pretty substantial area.
So if you give them extra oxygen, they come alive, huh?
Well, you nourish them. They can make energy now. They can make that ATP that they need. You know, cars run on gas, cells run on ATP. If they can make ATP because we're giving them oxygen, that's wonderful. And that's what's happening.
So it nourishes the tissue and it increases the circulation. That's much like what the photon stimulator does.
Exactly what it does. And, of course, it's an easier way to do much of the same thing. And it's not one or the other. I would say use them both.
There's other things that help strokes, too, or well, acupuncture, and what about...
Well, before we get on to those, let's stick on this infrared light therapy, this okay. photonic stimulation for a minute.
That's my little baby.
That does a lot of things to our biochemistry that's very impressive, and they happen almost instantly. So when that infrared light, that near-infrared light, shines on brain tissue, and it goes through the skull, by the way, what happens is you have an instant release of nitric oxide in blood vessels that are in spasm. So in that peri-infarction area where there's limited blood flow, you can dilate up those blood vessels, and all of a sudden you're giving it energy that it didn't have before, and it can do its work. So it's doing relatively the same thing that the hyperbaric oxygen is doing, slightly different way. So, it also, see, it does more than that, Vicki. It also makes ATP. When you shine the light on the brain, and that light hits the mitochondria, which is the energy-producing packet in the cell of those neurons that are in limbo there, it all of a sudden spurs them on to make more ATP. So you're converting that light energy into energy that is chemical energy, which is ATP. So now you've done two things. You've increased the circulation, and you've increased the ATP. But there are other things it does as well. It increases lymphatic drainage, so there's less congestion, and there's more room there. It speeds up healing, according to NASA studies, by 50%. And it relieves pain, but that's not an issue in this situation. So all those things, think about combining the technologies together.
Wow, that would be awesome, huh?
Use the hyperbaric oxygen because you want to get as much oxygen as you can there. Use the infrared light. And now tell us about those
other
things.
And then you could throw in the acupuncture and the neurofeedback.
You bet. So acupuncture, we all know. Neurofeedback, nobody much out there understands.
It's also considered EEG biofeedback, electroencephalogram biofeedback.
Okay, so that gives you a little bit more clue of what's happening. But basically what happens is when you've had a head trauma from either physical trauma, like getting hit with a bat on the head or being in an accident or having a stroke or some other kind of metabolic problem, the brain kind of goes into a state of disarray. It's much like when your computer freezes and it's stuck and you have to push the reset button. That's what neurofeedback does. That's what this EEG biofeedback does. So now there are we've got four tools that we can use that are generally not used in the mainstream that should be there because strokes are probably the most feared thing, the most feared disability that we have.
And it sounds like that there would be a value in Alzheimer's and other and central nervous diseases and multiple sclerosis and ALS and trauma.
Well, you'd have to think that they could provide more energy for the cells to use. But you'd also have to wonder about what are you doing about the disease process.
How does this compare to those oxygen bars? Remember how those popular?
That's a fake. There's not much there. I mean, what you're taking in through your lungs with just a little bit more oxygen isn't much. And I think that was mostly a placebo effect. But, you know, God bless them.
Well, how much oxygen do they get with the hyperbaric oxygen?
It's 10 times as much as in the atmosphere.
It's a lot of pressure, too, huh?
Yeah. Well, sure, it's a lot of pressure. So we have a technology here that needs to be brought forward into the mainstream, and, of course, in combination with all these other things.
I also want to just mention, for people that have had a stroke, this can even work 20 years later.
Yeah, well, that's right, because tissues stay alive for a long time, even if they can't function, and that's what's happening in this setting. So the more that we do to support them, the better the chances that they can recover. And they may even do, you know, we are all talking about neuroplasticity, where new cells are born and stem cells come in there and start regenerating. Maybe all they need is a little kickstart. You know, you give them a little bit of oxygen, you provide them a little bit of infrared light, you throw a little acupuncture in, a little neurofeedback, and voila, all of a sudden you've got something. That's a whole different story that's fantastic.
Where now they can squeeze your hand.
Exactly. All right. It's time for a network station break. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. We'll be right back with more Prescriptions for Health radio. And we'll be talking about, does what a cow eats affect your risk for heart disease? So stay tuned for more Prescriptions for Health radio. Welcome back to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki.
We've all heard the expression, we are what we eat. And if a food's organic, meaning without pesticides and grown in rich soil, or the meat's free-range or grass-fed, out to pasture, we should know that it'll be healthier than genetically engineered corn-fed beef or caged chickens or farm fish as opposed to wild. We also know that chickens out to pasture produce healthier eggs, rich in omega-3s, and organic milk doesn't have the added growth hormones, antibiotics, and pesticides. Yes, we have much better chance of being healthy if we eat healthy. So let's talk about the Oregon State University study about the happy cows and what they eat.
That's great. You know, before we get into that, I just want to make a comment about it's so weird that doctors in their training don't have any education in nutrition, very little in toxicity. And here we are talking about a topic like this that's so vitally important, because if the food that we grow doesn't have the nutrients in it, how in the world is it going to serve us and our metabolic needs?
Plus, if they're contaminated with pesticides and hormones and antibiotics and all that, that affects us as well.
That's exactly right. So there's not much we can do if we don't know better, and I think we have to start in our medical schools for sure. But that article you're talking about was published in the Journal of Dairy Science in January of 2013, and it was an Oregon State University study. And what they did is they pointed out what you did, that the traditional cattle are fed corn and grain, and it's genetically engineered, and some alfalfa hay and some grass silage, and that's good. But the omega-3s and the unsaturated fatty acids are low. And the question is why? It's because what they're eating doesn't have what the cow needs to be able to make those substances we're talking about. So what they did is these researchers took 10 pregnant cows, and what they did is they fed them varying amounts of flax, and they determined that about 6 pounds a day of flax seeds, which is a pretty good amount of flax seeds, turned out to lower saturated fat by 18%, increase the polyunsaturated fatty acids 82%, which is good news, and increase the omega-3s by 70%.
But doesn't this sound really expensive? I know when I buy flaxseed oil in the health food store, it's really expensive.
Well, it is, but if they just do the flax seeds, that's different. You're buying the best top-of-the-line oil that's organic, and that's why that's so expensive. But if they just had regular flax seeds, I mean, that could be done.
But they also did mention in the article that consumers are willing to pay more for omega-3 fatty acids.
No question. But what you have to keep in mind is just this little thing that says, crap in, crap out, right?
Oh, my goodness.
You don't eat the right thing. What you're going to get when you eat that product is the same thing that went into it. The human body is the same. We talk about that we are what we eat, and there's no question about that. But if we're not well, it also looks at what do we absorb and what do we deliver to the right places. It gets very complicated. So
this shows that you can actually eat beef that's fed flax seeds, and it can lower your risk of heart disease. Because a lot of people worry about if you eat the saturated fat and meat that, I mean, I don't know that that's true, but I mean, a lot of people worry about that. And I know doctors tell many of their cardiac patients to stay away from saturated fats and meat.
Well, I mean, saturated fat is not bad for us. Fact is, we need saturated fat. You can't make cholesterol
without
it. We
need some.
Well, you can't make cholesterol without it. Okay.
A lot of people don't want cholesterol.
You didn't have cholesterol, you'd be dead.
Yeah, I mean, but a lot of people have too much.
Well, let's point out, they actually have cholesterol that's unbalanced, meaning that they have too much of the low-density lipoproteins, which usually occur when our body's inflamed. But if our body's not inflamed, the more the better, really up to...
Like the HDL.
Yeah. I mean, cholesterol of 250 or 300 is a very healthy place to be. If you have a lot of HDL and you don't have much of the LDL, you can't make vitamin D. You can't make the sex hormones. You can't make cell membranes. You can't make many neurotransmitters in the brain. The brain is loaded with cholesterol. The problem is when we inflame our cholesterol because it's because our bodies are inflamed, then it starts causing problems that backfire and start leading to these problems where we get plaques in our arteries, and that leads to heart attacks and strokes and all those problems that go with it. So there's a lot going on here. that I think is important. So it's good to have good saturated fats in your diet. I think you need to have them. What you don't want to do is eat a lot of those saturated fats if your body's inflamed. And the point that a lot of doctors would make is, well, aren't our bodies inflamed just because we live on planet Earth and we've done all the things we have to it? And that answer is yes, of course we have. So that's what we're dealing with. So now, what are we going to do in terms of changing our lifestyle? What are we going to do to change what we're doing with our medical education? How are we going to get medical schools to start look at teaching our doctors something about nutrition?
Instead of just giving patients prescriptions and doling out statins like candy.
Well, that's what happens. So what we have is a system here that says follow the dollars. You know, I'm always saying follow the dollars because they'll tell you why certain things happen in healthcare. And that needs to be stopped. If we're going to do that, we have to change the way the system works, because right now the pharmaceutical industry is boss. Why? Because it's got all the money. The medical schools don't have much in the way of money. So what would entice the pharmaceutical companies to provide money to the educational system at the medical schools? Do our research for us, please. Let us interpret it the way we want. No, don't be looking so much for cures, because what we're giving you are ways to block symptoms, and everybody's happy to a point, except we, the people, who are the ones that are getting the product. So there's something awfully wrong with that system that must be changed, or we're going to be continuing to do what we're doing. So unless we evolve to a higher level of consciousness in our culture where we put service in front of profitability, we're screwed. There's nowhere to go. We're going to continue with this system because that's what everybody is functioning by. And so the almighty dollar is what rules how we do our business and what we get in return for the products that we pay for.
It's good for people to be aware of all this anyway. It's just like if you go to a fancy steakhouse.
Oh, right. No question.
I mean, you go there and they're like, oh, we've got this corn-fed beef.
Yeah, exactly.
Like that's a really healthy thing. Or what about the time when we went to Uruguay and our friend filled up his plate and we figured out later that it was probably because this chicken was filled with hormones.
Sure.
It made it so big. It was the same thing with the steak.
Well, you have to pay attention to what you're eating, because unless you're eating food that's decent, you're not going to get much in the way of the good nutrition that you need. And the system that we have that's built on dollars rather than on quality makes it so that the poor people in this country don't have a chance of really being healthy.
Well, people that don't know any better are attracted to what it looks like. So when you go to the store and you see this red meat that looks so healthy and everything, you don't know that it's full of all these drugs and antibiotics and food coloring and everything else. It's the same thing with fish. They try to tell you, oh, it's organic farmed fish.
Yeah, right.
But there's nothing like eating the wild. That's what you want.
If you get something natural, stick with that. If it looks like a zucchini, it's food. If it's a food product, it's going to be in a package usually with a cellophane around it, and it's going to have an ingredients list.
Or if a chicken's been raised in a cage and just sitting there getting fat, what do you think you're eating? You're just eating this poor tortured chicken that's just nothing but unhealthy fat.
Well, what are they putting in it is the question, and it's not a lot in the way of nutrition. So what you put in determines what you get out, and that's what this is all about.
That's why you said crap in and crap out.
Well, that's exactly right, because that's a lot of what we're eating, and with the disparities being where they are, the way they are, you go into indigent neighborhoods and you can't get organic food. You can't get grass-fed beef. You're lucky if you go to a restaurant and you can get a lot of those things, because that's just exactly the way that they do it. Anyway, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Lynn Spooter here with Nurse Vicki, and it's time for Nurse Vicki's final 2020 tip on, now that I'm older, this is what I've discovered. And when we come back, we'll be talking about, are immunized kids healthier? And are NSAIDs safe for kids? Stay tuned.
Now that I'm older, here's what I discovered. As I was lying in bed pondering the problems of the world, I rapidly realized that I don't really care. It's the tortoise life for me. If walking is good for your health, the postman would be immortal. A whale swims all day, only eats fish, drinks water, and he's fat. A rabbit runs and hops and only lives 15 years. A tortoise doesn't run and does nothing, yet it lives for 450 years. And you tell me to exercise? I don't think so. I'm retired. Go around me. God grant me the senility to forget the people I never liked, the good fortune to run into the ones I do, and the eyesight to tell the difference. Now that I'm older, here's what I've discovered. I started out with nothing, and I still have most of it. My wild oats have turned into prunes and all bran. I finally got my head together, and now my body's falling apart. Funny, I don't remember being absent-minded. If all is not lost, where is it? It is easier to get older than it is to get wiser. Some days you're the dog, some days you're the hydrant. I wish the buck stopped here. I sure could use a few. Kids in the back seat cause accidents. Accidents in the back seat cause kids. It's hard to make a comeback when you haven't been anywhere. The only time the world beats a path to your door is when you're in the bathroom.
That's the truth.
If God wanted me to touch my toes, he'd have put them on my knees.
Indeed.
When I'm finally holding all the cards, why does everyone want to play chess? It's not hard to meet expenses. They're everywhere. The only difference between a rut and a grave is the depth.
True.
Now, these days, I spend a lot of time thinking about the hereafter. I go somewhere to get something and then wonder what I'm here after. Funny, I don't remember being absent-minded. And did I tell you this before?
Humor
and laughter is the best medicine.
Well, it is, and it sort of reveals a lot of things in life that are kind of interesting.
Well, and it's also healthy to laugh at ourselves.
Very healthy.
So, under vaccination of babies 2 to 24 months.
Here we go.
Is an increasing trend that's gotten mainstream medicine into an uproar. And the mainstream doctors and scientists are accusing those parents who have under vaccinated babies of setting the stage for an epidemic that's a threat to the human race.
Yeah, give me a break.
Well, as a consequence, 15 scientists got together and they did this large study intended to show that babies vaccinated according to the CDC's recommendation would be healthier than those who did not follow the schedule properly or did not accept all the vaccines. So what did they find and what did they report?
Well, they had bad luck. I mean, it's interesting how things turn out. You know, they were so sure they were right. And, of course, it's no surprise to me that it turned out as it did. But really what irks me is that when scientists do a study and then they don't interpret it honestly, that gives the wrong impression to people because this was their intent at the start. It was obvious. But what do they title the study? A population-based cohort study of under vaccination in 8 managed care organizations across the U.S.
That doesn't tell you anything.
That doesn't tell you much, except they're studying kids that were under vaccinated. And what's their conclusion? This bites me right in the rear end. Under vaccination appears to be an increasing trend. Under vaccinated children appear to have different health care utilization patterns compared with age-appropriately vaccinated children.
So what does that say?
It means that they did a study that didn't turn out right, and they're not fessing up.
And so what it really showed was that kids with fewer vaccines have fewer doctor and emergency room visits.
That is what it showed, and that was published. Another organization looked at the way they interpreted that, got the same indigestion that we got, and decided to straighten them out. And so they reviewed this thing, and they came to the conclusion that if you read the data that they published that's included in this article, that it showed the reverse, that the kids were vaccinated did worse. Kids with fewer vaccines have fewer doctor and emergency room visits. Hello? How could things like that happen? It's people with an attitude that have their mind made up based on something that's not good science, and then not fessing up when they do the study that shows the difference and basically lie to the people who read it. That's, to me, outrageous.
The other thing is they didn't even put kids in the study that didn't have any vaccines.
I know. That would
just
have been the real
study. Just the under-vaccinated ones.
Yeah, well, that's a way of cheating a little bit, because that would be the simple thing to do. And, of course, it's what I've been saying for decades, and what Tom Jefferson of the Institute of the Cochrane Study has also suggested. He's probably the world's foremost person in influenza vaccines.
Well, one of the reasons is because the pediatricians fire the patients.
They do.
That don't get the vaccines. They say, I'm not going to treat you if you don't get a vaccine. Talk about pressure.
Well, it's not fair that doctors do that, because, and it's not fair to the doctors either, because let's face it, most doctors now are in what, big HMOs. They work for Kaiser, they work for the government or some other big organization, and they're not in control of their practices anymore, and they have to do what they're told to do. In fact, now with the flu vaccine, if they don't take the flu vaccine, they got to wear a mask, which is to me just as outrageous, because the flu vaccine is probably one of the worst examples of a method to try and prevent disease that hasn't been proven.
Well, the Institute of Medicine is trying to say that the vaccines are safe, and that's without research backing. The other
a lot of statements that are made by proclamation. Not good science. And mind you, Vicki and I aren't opposed to vaccines at all. What we're opposed to is bad science. I'd be the first one to get my immunization if there was some science behind it.
Well, last year, the kids that got the whooping cough were the ones that got the whooping cough vaccine. And have you noticed all these ads on TV for getting the whooping cough?
Yeah, well, it's the kids that got the vaccine that got the disease is what you're trying to say.
Isn't that what I said?
No,
they got
but
the
that's
whooping
okay.
cough.
The kids that were vaccinated got more episodes of whooping cough than the kids that weren't vaccinated. So hello there. So this is something that we have to wake up to. I mean, immunizations are like the golden arches of medicine. We go back and assume that they must be good because of the way the CDC handles this, the way the World Health Organization handles it, and it is not good science. So
the other thing I wanted to bring up here was that there were two groups that were under-vaccinated. And
right.
Maybe we should talk about the difference in those two groups.
Absolutely.
Compared to the group that was vaccinated.
Yeah, because, see, two things happened here. One is the first study comes out and it lies to us, gives us the wrong answers. The second group comes out and says, well, if you actually look at your data, it says the reverse of what you're claiming. And that's terrible. But for the first people, but it's good for the second people. But the real truth of what happens here is that we're looking at groups here that are not identical. They're different. The group that had that didn't get their vaccines on time was one of the groups that they looked at in this study. The other group that didn't get their vaccines didn't get it because of parental objections. They didn't. Parental choice was different.
Well, so some of them didn't object totally. They just wanted to delay it, to have the child be a little bit older, or to give them a little bit more space in between, or maybe not give them
but
so many
But in general,
all
they
at
got
once.
They got fewer immunizations
right.
by design.
Right.
Now, what's the difference between these two groups? Well, the group that doesn't get their vaccines on time and thinks they're supposed to do it are probably not taking as good a care of their kids, because they can't manage to get them to their scheduled appointments with their doctors to be able to have their vaccines. The other group that doesn't get as many vaccines is totally different. These are parents that are a lot of the time really concerned about their kids, and they're determined that they're not going to do anything to harm their kids. So we've got groups that are not comparable.
And the group where the parents were conscious about it mm-hmm. and concerned about their kids and worried about autism and some of the other problems
right.
that you can get, SIDS and so forth.
Sure, maybe.
Their children had fewer emergency room visits than the children that were vaccinated. And they also had the same number of hospitalizations, and they had fewer outpatient visits. So
okay,
it
so,
seems like they did a little better.
So what we're saying here is the group of those kids who were not getting their vaccines on time because they just were kind of lazy about getting them or whatever happened, had more hospitalizations than the other two groups. They had 20% more hospitalizations. So what this is showing is that one of the major differences in what happened here is that if parents are really concerned about things, whether it's giving them all their vaccines or it's not giving their vaccines by deliberation, they do better than the group of parents who just were lazy about giving the vaccines. That's what this study showed. So it was looking at the kind of parent that was in the group. So that's how I would interpret this situation.
Yeah, so if the parents are caring and more concerned about
their
patient,
they do better
if
they're caring, whichever way they go. And the major thing is no real substantial difference between the kids that were immunized and the kids that got fewer immunizations. And as a matter of fact, they had 6% fewer outpatient visits and 9% fewer emergency room visits. And this was a study with 323,000 kids. So I think it's showing, if anything, the reverse of what the original people said.
You know, we've all heard that non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, NSAIDs, such as ibuprofen and naproxen and so forth, can have troubling side effects like bleeding and heart attacks and strokes. And yet the doctors continue to prescribe them, knowing that they cause 30,000 deaths a year and 300,000 hospitalizations.
Isn't that something?
And yet we give them to our babies and to our children.
It's unbelievable.
And, you know, if this isn't enough, a new study just published in the Journal of Pediatrics just reported that NSAIDs can cause serious permanent kidney damage in children. You know what hacks me off is just the other day I was watching Kelly and Michael on TV, you know, Kelly Ripa, and they had a game going or something that was being sponsored by Children's Motrin.
Oh, there we go.
She makes this big statement
about,
it's so wonderful. My son had a really high fever and I didn't know what to do, and it took care of his fever.
Yeah, right.
So let's talk about what happens with these NSAIDs.
Well, these are dangerous drugs that, in my opinion, should not be on the market at all. They should all be black box, right, at the very least, which means that there should be a warning on them that's saying these things can be lethal. When you're seeing all these kinds of problems develop in people who have are taking them, it's heart attacks and strokes and kidney disease, ulcers and perforations, and 30,000 people, like you're saying, I mean, that's not thought to be anything that's significant. I mean, you have to do something to manage pain. I agree. You don't have to give kids aspirin or give them NSAIDs or Tylenol if they have a fever. A fever is a good thing. The body
fights
doesn't
infection.
It makes your metabolic rate go up. Your enzymes work better. A lot of things work
better.
If
it's way too high and you're afraid of a convulsion or something with a baby, you can give them a tepid bath and rub their skin lightly and quickly. That's with friction.
Yeah, that's right. So there are lots of things that can be done in place of that. And what happens is these NSAIDs are restricting blood flow to little tiny tubules, the glomerulus in the kidney.
So this means that they're even worse to take if you have a fever.
Yeah.
Because you're dehydrated.
Exactly. And kids under 5 are the most vulnerable. And what they found is that 30% of these kids had ongoing kidney disease. So we're looking at something that it should never have been an issue in the first place. There's no reason that kids should be taking any of these drugs or anybody else should be taking any of these drugs, because it's just the wrong thing to do. So I would say that until we find something better, we should rely on the tepid bath or try to do things that are found in complementary and alternative medicine. Well, we're at the end of the show, and I'd like to remind you that we'll be back to talk live about what's new in the news and health every Monday morning on PRN.FM and DrSabuto.com from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. Prescriptions for health will also be available 24/7 on DrSabuto.com as well as PRN.FM.
And if you enjoyed today's show and you would like to have more information on the topics we discussed, go to Dr. Saputo Radio on DrSabuto.com and check out our Fast Track videos. And remember, a healthy lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe. So if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life.
Have a great week. We'll see you next time.